Thank you. And Steve, as somebody who's come out of a Methodist tradition that was very strong on holiness, I think that it's wonderful you are doing that. And I've been reflecting lately that probably one of the tragedies of the last 10 to 20 years where we've seen all of these scandals in the church is because we lost an emphasis that other generations really held up very, very high. And so Raj, I don't know some of the other speakers, but Raj Gupta's a great guy and I know him very well. I'm sure that'll be terrific. Okay, can we start to run raising resources for a building? Some of this will overlap with what we've done before. Certainly. By and large, we didn't follow at that stage of detail. What tends to happen is that people who have made large commitments always tend to follow them up. You know, if you've made a commitment of $200 a week, that's a serious amount. You've gone home, you've prayed about it with your wife, and you tend to keep on giving, and you've often, you know, you do it electronically. The ones that tend not to be maybe so much are the ones that might have made $2 or $5 a week or something, and just the spur of the moment stuff. So we didn't tend to do it, though I know that other churches did. They set up a system. And while it might seem a little bit, a bit pedantic, I know that, that in some places it uncovered fraud, which is very sad, in the sense that, you know, you might have signed a card and you might be saying, oh, look, I'm going to give $100 a week, and I'm checking it off, and I find that you haven't done anything for 3 or 4 months. Well, I mean, one of the things I can do is go out and have a conversation and say, look, is there anything going on in your life? Can we help you? But secondly, you might say, but I've been giving my money. Right? And then, and that was pulled up in a church very close to us, and they found out that people were skimming. And so it does have an advantage, but we didn't tend to go to that sort of detail. But you could probably the people were giving electronically, yes, well you'd know that. Oh yes, because one was signing commitment cards. The projects were given, the money for the project came in at the same time. They were given a special envelope. I didn't make that clear. They were given a special marked envelope. Sorry, I was racing through at the end. A special marked envelope, and those six projects were listed on the envelope, and then you'd tick a box as to which one you wanted the money to go to, so it was in there. So yes, sorry, thank you for that, yeah. All right. Raising money resources for a building. Let me tell you a little backstory. When I went to Fig Tree, it was a congregation that wanted to make a difference. They had built a building, but it was unfinished. I went there in 1987, and the building project had gone on in the early 80s, and there was a great amount of joy to the fact that they had this nice new building. It was designed by an architect who never went to church, and so while it was a lovely building and the people were very proud of it, it was totally impractical. For example, it was supposed to seat 356 people. I saw it written on the plans, but it was made in a hexagonal way, and those 366 people would have had to be ants to get in there. That centre section was pretty full at 100, not 356. Simple reason was, because it was hexagonal, nobody had bothered to actually work out the area of it and figure out how many people would go in there. I mean, it was crazy. If you've got a square, it's just length by breadth, you can get the area easy. Nobody bothered to do that. And so we had overflow areas that were always in use from day one. So you had first-class seating, second-class seating, all sorts of stuff. And they had a rectory that they'd built on the property, so it was just behind the church. So they used up some of their precious land with a rectory, and it was brand new. So I was there, and within within a couple of months I could see this was a crazy situation, but they all loved it. And they didn't see the inhibiting effect of this process, but also it was unfinished. I mean, the roof, there was an external roof, but there was no internal roof. There were just wires hanging out of the roof, and the offices weren't filled in. And so gradually over the years, we had individual projects to do some of those little things. But we got to the stage where I put to the congregation that we build a new building, and that's where my trouble started. The first time, I said that we would make a 66% vote of a special meeting would be needed to get this through. We got 62%. I didn't carry the people with me. I just didn't understand what I needed to do that. And because they loved their building and they loved their rectory on site, and the rectory was going to have to be demolished and the building was going to have to be used for other things, and we had to build a new auditorium, and they just couldn't see it. And I hadn't built up enough trust and credibility with people to do it. We did it again. We came and put the to the congregation about 3 years later, and we got a 95% vote to go and do it. And we made the vote that we would, the motion was that we would put up a building within, we would examine, get the plans, and put the building up within 2 years. More fool me. That process took about 5 to 10 years, I can't remember the details. One of the things I learned, if you've got a building project, you do all your plans, you do all your praying, you do all your thinking, you do all your checking, you figure it all out, you double check it, you triple check it, and it'll take twice as long and twice as much. And for us, that was pretty much exactly right. And so this is a big project. The first thing that you've got to realise, that people in the pews, they don't generally see why you need it. You will see why you need it, but they don't see. They like their little church the way it is. If they're getting fellowship and friendship from folk, they're not thinking big gospel vision. They're not thinking the people are not coming in the door because they haven't got a children's ministry facility there. They just love what they love. And so you've got to put your project in people terms. You've got to say people, 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 until you are so sick of hearing it, you think you'll go absolutely insane. We multiplied congregations rather than church plant. We're in a funny situation. And remember, things have moved on now. There's a very strong set of church planting movements around Australia now that weren't there, say, 30 years ago. Also, I was in Wollongong. I had a very strong Anglican church all around me. So if I was going to church plant, I was going to church plant in the backyard of the next church, which was doing a great job, and doing and whose minister was a friend. And back then, too, I was not allowed to do it under Anglican law. I once wanted to move one of my services into the local school hall, and was 100 metres into the next parish. And the rector of that parish, who was an evangelical, who was a missionary, who loved Jesus, who I met with every month, refused me permission. So, so you've got those sort of things. I mean, the issue is, I think you need a big centre base before you start planting the little ones. But people who do this, see, I'm part of I go to a very big Baptist church, and they are church planting, and they're saying don't want to do it if they can't start with 200. Because the critical mass needs to be that way. But that's their thing. And the Americans do it even bigger. Because you're not sending out people that are, where congregations are really, really struggling for a long time. But anyway, that's another thing. But either way, the church I go to is needing money for home base and they need money for church planting. So whatever you need, it's a big project, you need money for it. Okay, so you need, if you're going to do it for building, it's all about vision, and you've got to sort of say to yourself, why are we doing this? Now, I'm on importance of vision, yeah. Why are we doing this? Your vision has got to be linked to a God-honoring future. And it's just, you've got to show people why this building is going to change lives for Jesus. It's that simple. Why this building is going to enhance the fellowship that you're going to have in the building. Like, if you're going to build a new foyer, well, new foyers are really important, and big buildings have big foyers. A lot of churches are dying because they just don't have a foyer. But a foyer is an architectural expression of community. And you've got to, so you don't, yeah, you tell them about the foyer, but you tell them about why the foyer is there. Because you want people to come to church and you want them to engage with one another and you want to be able to have cups of tea and you want to be able to have Christian conversations afterwards and you want that sense of engagement to be able to happen afterwards. And so whatever you're doing in that building, has got to be put in people terms. You want to build a children's ministry centre. Well, then you talk about the children that are inside and you talk about the way they need to have the love of Jesus given to them. And you talk about where they're going to end up in 5, 10, 15, 20 years' time. And you talk about them as the leaders of tomorrow. And you talk about them as the church of today. Yvonne used to say, don't tell me the children are the church of tomorrow. Tell me they're the church of today. I said, yeah, okay, they're the leaders of tomorrow. I take Yvonne's point. but you've got to express that in people terms and you've got to show people everywhere. So good pictures of buildings or good videos about buildings are all about, they're not just about the plans and the architecture and all that. You've got to show that, but you've also got to show the people that are going to be changed and affected by that. And that was my big mistake. And because when I started off this, it never entered my head that people would not get that. And I found out that really people thought that I wanted a big architectural monument to be a monument to me. I mean, it's mad what goes on inside people's mind, but I kept thinking, I did not go and flog myself for 4 years through Moore College to come out and be an architect. I came out to be a gospel minister, and this is what you need to do to help that. But I didn't get that. So later on, I learnt my lesson by being very, very burnt. And so it's got to be a part of a God-honoring future. Now, I just want to read you something, if I can find it, because it came in just yesterday into my inbox. I just quickly printed it out. I still get a newsletter from Rick Warren, and it's called Holiday Giving Campaigns. But take away the holiday, and this is what his number, he got 4 points. Number one. Share a compelling vision. This is what he says. People don't give to meet needs. They give to fulfill a vision. People give when big dreams capture their imagination. People give when they get a big picture view of what you're doing in the world and how their generosity can play a part. At Saddleback, we've been privileged to be part of some of the largest giving campaigns ever. People ask me all the time, how do you raise so much money? How do you get big gifts? You get big gifts with big dreams. John Maxwell says, how do you raise $1 million? You have $1 million vision. By far your most important responsibility when inspiring generosity is to cast the vision. The vision isn't the amount you're trying to raise. The vision is what God wants to do with your money. It's about the people you're going to reach. It's about the needs you'll meet. Always start with a why, never the what. The vision is about the why. When you clearly communicate the why, God will show you the what and the how. Make sure you answer these questions for your congregation. Why should people give to this cause? Why must they give now? Once you're clear about the vision behind the need, you can help people in your congregation understand their part in fulfilling it. Well, Warren is the master. There's no doubt about that. So, when you learn that, you've got to start expressing it And you start to think ministry. That's the good thing. You stop thinking buildings, because buildings are just a home base for the ministry that you're going to do. Like to make any comment on that? Yes. Yeah, I was going to mention a little bit about that in the preaching. Interestingly enough, percentage-wise, people on lower incomes give a bigger percentage than those on higher incomes. So the thing is, what you're trying to do with your congregation is to stimulate them to be generous. And the point that you've raised is a very valid one. Because you will realize that most of them, you want everybody to be a participant. Very important for everybody to be a participant. So even the widow's mite, as the Lord said, is very important. But the major part of your money is going to come from what they call the deep pocket donors. And so you need a campaign that incorporates everybody, that encourages everybody to be generous, but you also recognise that some don't have the ability to give that others do, and that's got to be and you communicate that. And when I was preaching, look, I'm going to do that in the preaching thing, so I'll keep that a little bit later. Yep. Somebody else? Yep. Yep. Oh, look, absolutely. And you've got to try and, if you're a new minister, you've got to try and get runs on the board on small things immediately. When I went to Fig Tree, to give you an example, they'd had a good ministry by a fine leader, but he'd been gone for 9 months. And so I was told that I had a parish council meeting almost immediately. I'd only been to one parish council in my life as a curate, and I hadn't run it. I'd just been an observer. But I'd been told that these meetings went on till 12:30 in the morning. The first thing I did was study meetings. And I wanted to run a really good meeting the first time, and I wanted it to finish at 10 o'clock. And so the first input that I had into the life of that parish, apart from the first service, was running that meeting. And so they came away thinking, I don't want to be up till 12:30 at night. This new guy finishes off at 10. We get home early. Tick. Then I wanted to make Easter a really, really good time. So we did a big thing at Easter. Then I put on a ministry conference in August. They'd never had one before. And I didn't have a clue what to do, but I just wanted to make it good. So I wanted all the way to try and raise the profile of everything that we did. We actually did well. The other thing was the services never started on time. They would start at 10 past 10 or 10 past 8. First thing I did was I used to say to the service leaders, I do not care whether you can shoot a bowling ball through this place. I don't care when they come. You start on the time. We actually had a bit of a joke about it many years later, because this is 15 years later when I knew a lot of them, I said, yes, honestly, I said, you know, you've got all these band people and that, they've worked all hard this week, and I've got to honestly say I love you, but you come in here like Brown's cows. And for weeks later, they would all come in going, moo, moo. but my point is that everything you do, you've got to make sure it's done well. and you tighten all those things up, and then you make your ask for a small increase. Okay? And then when the small increase comes, you celebrate it. You give thanks to God for it. You thank the people for it. And then you ask for a larger one. But that you've got to build up the trust issue, and you can start from the very day you walk in the door. Funnily enough, for us, when I'd been there 18 months, in 1 week, we had a very big funeral of a very loved leader. So half the church turned up to him, and I think the funeral sermon went well. It honoured God and honoured him. And then only about 3 or 4 days later, two of the most popular people in the church got married, and half the rest of the church turned up to them. And so I'd put a lot of work both into those messages and doing that absolutely as well as possible. So you build up all this credibility, and you try never to surrender it. Okay. Biblical visionary projects. There are a number of them. For instance, you've got Moses and the tabernacle in Exodus 15. It's very worthwhile, and I'd love to be able to take you through some of the aspects of it. But one of the great things about it is Moses has to tell the people to stop. It's great. Get up and say, what a day it is today when I'd be able to, I get up before you and say, stop giving, we've got too much money. Well, that's what Moses did. What a people, what a God. You know, you get up and talk. And so you produce it with a lot of joy. David and the temple in 1 Chronicles, I'll talk a bit more about that. Paul and the collection in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, absolutely riddled with theological discussion. And funnily enough, Nehemiah. In Nehemiah 7:72, there is buried in an odd chapter that people hardly ever read, right at the end, you find the same principle that was there in King David. The governor gives, his amount is noted. The sum of the leaders gave, and their amount is noted. And you notice some of it. But if you know Nehemiah, some of the leaders in that congregation had to be ticked off by Nehemiah, so I suspect they weren't particularly the most spiritual people. And then the people gave, and their amount was noted. I thought, I just found this in my Bible reading. I thought, wow, it's the same pattern as in King David. So they were some examples of biblical visionary projects, and they're good to be able to take apart and pray about and preach on. And I've certainly done that, but a lot of the campaigns that I learnt were roughly modelled on David and the temple. Okay? And there is a great visionary project there. You know that David has a heart to build a temple to the glory of God. He wants to build a house. And God says to him, you're not going to build a house. I'm going to build you a house. And there's this great theological discussion going on in 2 Samuel 7. However, the building of the temple still goes ahead, and David prepares a whole pile of stuff for the temple. Okay, he prepares all the necessary preparation, but God has told him that he's not going to be the one who does it. You know, he's the man of war. Solomon, the man of peace, is going to be the one who does it. But at the end of that preparation process, the last thing David does is raise the money. And that chapter, 1 Chronicles 29, I took that as the basis of one of my generosity sermons that I just preached just recently. It's just a wonderful, wonderful chapter, just dripping in theology that God is the Lord of all, He is the owner, that we are nothing, we owe it all to Him, and we give Him all the glory. And it's just a brilliant chapter to preach on. David raises the money, and it's that situation where David gives, the elders give, and the people give and rejoice, and Solomon continues the task. And in 1 Chronicles 29 itself, you can break that up. You see, David leads by example. The community leaders give, and they give willingly. The people rejoice. David acknowledges God's blessing. And that's the prayer I was telling you about. It's just a brilliant prayer. I just took that prayer and preached on it. I basically just used the others just as a very quick illustration and then preached on the prayer, because it's all about God, and it's all about His goodness, and it's all about His grace, and it's all about His mercy and His generosity, And David says, and who are we? And who are my people that we should, you know, we should give this amount? It all belongs to you. I mean, it's just wonderful. And then there is a great time of celebration. So the campaigns are based on the fact that you have a great visionary project and you ask, you lead by example and you ask the people in gospel terms, David says, who will consecrate himself to the Lord today? You know, remember Paul says they gave themselves to the Lord and then to us. It's all about the heart, you see. And then David acknowledges God's blessing and they have this time of celebration. Well, you build all of those things into your campaign. And that's why you have a commitment series, but you also have a celebratory dinner and you want to celebrate what God has done. And those aspects of vision and direct asking and celebrating God's goodness and preaching and finally having a dinner and a celebration, well, they're the broad outlines of what you're trying to do in a commitment day or what you're trying to do, because a commitment day for a building is a big deal. It's you know, you've got your regular commitment days for ordinary money, but this is a standalone. If you're trying to raise a few million dollars, as we were, that's got to be really, really well looked after. So that's the first thing. Now, pause there. You want to come back on any of that? There will be some overlap with what's before. However, I don't apologise for that because it's important to say some of this stuff over and over and over again. This is what is needed out of the leadership. The leadership needs a commitment. You really need to be on board. And let me tell you how I got this. There was a bloke up the road from me, up there, up in the Fig Tree is in the parish of Fig Tree, obviously. But up the road from us, really they could pretty much throw a rock on our roof if you had a decent slingshot, was the Wollongong Church of Christ, which was a very, very big church. It had been started, it had been, you know, put into the 1,000+ bracket by a very classy minister called Barry McMurtry and taken over by his friend, Ted Keating. And Ted, who I still keep up with, he's in Victoria, retired now, had in his early days been commissioned by the Church of Christ to be raising money for ministry. That was one of his first jobs. And so he knew a little bit about this. And I, when I came to try and raise big money, I'm talking about serious big money for a building, I didn't really know what to do. And I tried to get some help in Australia, but I found it difficult to do it. And I'll tell you how I worked it out later. But I went up to Ted and I said to him, if I went to a professional fundraiser and asked them, what should I be doing to raise the money for the building at Fig Tree, what would they tell me? Now, I tell you what Ted told me that day shook me to the core. It really gave me a serious attack because he looked at me and he said, Rod, they would tell you that you must make an inspirational commitment. And I just staggered out of his office. An inspirational commitment. And, you know, I was a bit shaky. Because, stupid me, I had thought that when I raised money for this building, then the rich people in the congregation, they'd give a bucket of money. And I'd certainly give money. But I didn't have to lead the charge in that sense because they would be doing it. Now, Fig Tree was middle class, so I didn't have lots of doctors and lawyers and things like that. I did have a couple, but not many. But it was middle class, you know, school teachers, computer programmers, people that worked at the steelworks, those sort of folk. And I came away and I realised that if the people of Fig Tree were going to make a multi-million dollar gift to the church, then Rod Irvine had to stand up like King David and he literally had to give sacrificially and people had to know it. And I went home and my wife and I prayed about this And we thought of the money that we should be able to give. And then we thought we need to stretch ourselves to the limit that we think we can do, and we did that. And then I listened to these sermons by Rick Warren when he raised his $22 million. And he was encouraging people, yes, do that, but then give by faith. Trust God. Trust God to give money that you haven't got, that you have no idea where it's going to come from. And I'm thinking, holy smoke, this is scary stuff. But we did. We added another $5,000 onto what we were doing. Maybe I should have added more, but I did. Anyway, so we on the day we started, I gave my amount out to the congregation. And it was very interesting. There was one bloke in the congregation who was known to be, generally, by the leadership, to be the bloke who gave the biggest amount to the church. He was known to be one of the big givers. He walked out after the service, and he turned to my associate, Bruce Clark, and he said, I thought this was going to be a high jump. He just made it a pole vault. That was exactly what I wanted. You know, I had to lead. I had to show that it wasn't the doctors and the lawyers and all the rest of it that were going to be the people who gave the big money. They wouldn't do it unless they could see that I had stretched myself to the limit and beyond. Because we had 5 kids. I've said to you, my wife is a professor of accounting. She wasn't then. She was basically a contract tutor in accounting at that stage. She might have been a part-time lecturer. So it wasn't that we were rich. So that's the first thing, that the leader must, you've got to be committed and you've got to be courageous, because you've got to push yourself outside your comfort zone. See, I want to say to clergy here, if you're anything like me, we all have our weaknesses. And we all have the things that we just simply don't want to do. Now, the next person might be able to do those things easily, but we just don't want to do them. It's basically in our DNA or our psyche or our personality type. We just simply don't want to go there. And we want, we need courage to go there. And I just figured out what needs to be done. Okay? Then, Rod, stop being a wimp and get on and do it. I don't care if you're uncomfortable, you know, to myself. You've got to get over that lack of comfort, if it's just a lack of comfort. But you know what clergy can do? We clergy, we're terrific at it. We can hide our own personal discomfort behind theology. And we can hide it with Greek words. I can find all sorts of clever theological reasons just simply to do the things that I don't want to do and the next guy would easily do. So I had to actually say to myself, I'm going to be committed to this, whatever it takes. I'm going to find out what it needs, and unless it's ungodly, I'm going to go and do it. And so that was the thing I did. It takes confidence. That you've got to. It means that you've got to prepare, and it means you've got to pray, and it forces you to your knees in a way that you've never done before. And I can remember I had a forest out the back of where our church backed onto the Wollongong Escarpment, and there was a forest out there, and I would go walking in the forest, and I'd be crying out to God, Lord, you must do this, because I cannot do it. Because you've got to be putting on a task that you cannot do unless the living God comes and does it with you. And that will push you outside your comfort zone, and you, of course, you need wisdom. You need to know when to do it, and you need to know how to do it. And I think processes like this will give you the wins, and the wisdom will give you, the wisdom comes from your prayer, but also your interaction with your congregation and things like that. So, thank you. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You'll always get the complainers. I tried to get the really strong leadership. You don't want yes people around you. You don't want yes men and women. I'm definitely not saying that. But I had a strong staff team, and on that staff team I had some very strong players. So I would often engage with them. But I had, a number of parish councillors that were particularly strong leadership people. And I would be bouncing off them all the time. And I knew that if we together made decisions, they would be wise and godly decisions. And they would tell me if I stepped out of line. And I wanted people like that. But I knew that if we were together, then we could go forward together. So, you know, I'm not talking about the thing where I get a bright idea and come down and sort of tell you that the Lord has told me we must do this, and if you don't like it, tough. But if I've got that leadership commitment with me, then Mr. and Mrs. Smith over here, who are just very negative, well, I can easily deal with that. I don't knock them. I just smile sweetly at them, love them, and keep on doing it. But that's correct. Okay. I'm just going to leave the next slide, thanks. We'll go on to the next one, but leave the next one and go on to the one after that, please. All right. I just want to give you a time frame for this. Now, maybe this reflects me. I'm a long-term planner. Do not give me last-minute things. That drives me nuts. But to do this properly, the professional fundraisers say that most of the time you need the professional fundraisers because the average person just doesn't do it right. And they've probably got a point. And the first thing is you need to be very well organised on this, and you need to start early. So if you are... I'm not a detailed person. I can do detail, but I'm not a detailed person. It's not where I live. I'm reasonably well organised, but because I don't particularly like the detail, it'll frustrate the living daylights out of me. So I had an absolutely first-rate office administrator. I don't mean the secretary. I had a first-rate secretary as well, or a number of them. But my administrator was a first-rate, smart lady who was very strong on detail. So I would get her to do the detail stuff for me. So I would simply say to you that if you are a clergy person and you're leading this process, you don't want to be doing the detail, because you've got to be doing the big picture vision casting and preaching, and you need all the other stuff to be done by other people, and you need an administrative type person who is really sharp to be there and to be driving the rest of the process, because there's a lot to it. We actually, this lady, Karen, that was in my office, so we liberated her from part of her regular duties by hiring another guy who was strong on detail to come in. He was temporarily out of work between jobs. He was a smart guy. And we hired him to come in for about 3 or 4 months and take part of her job so she could do that. So don't think you can do this without support. And if you're trying to raise millions of dollars, as we were, to spend a small amount of money on extra salary is pretty well done. Otherwise you'll fail. And the difference between a good campaign and a bad campaign can be hundreds of thousands, even $1 million. And you don't want to compromise that because of inefficiencies. So there's a time frame. We started 12 to 18 months before. So if you've got a building campaign that you want to be going, I'm not saying you can't do it in a shorter time frame, but you just need to know what you need to do. If you're starting from absolute scratch, you simply need to know and absorb the details. And I personally needed a fair bit of time to do that. If it's what now, it's October. You know, I would be thinking of a building campaign in October next year, or maybe March the year after. If it's a serious one and I really want it to do, because I want to get all those ducks in a row. And I also want to be able to preach the best I've ever preached in all my life. At 3 months out, in that 18, 12 months, you've got to have all your plans. It's got to be very clear. You've got to know what you're doing. You know, you've got to have effectively your building for your plans for the temple has all got to be worked out in that process. Then 3 months out, you generally have a preliminary launch. You're launching the project. Because remember, the people are going about their business. They're not thinking about your project. They might know it's on the cards, but they're thinking, you know, in our family, my mother-in-law, just died, and she died over a period of about 6 weeks. So you can imagine, we were totally distracted. My wife was up at the hospital every day for 6 weeks, for the last 6 weeks or so of her mother's life. So what's going on in church? I don't know. I don't care. And, you know, you go through the congregation. You know, a lot of people have got similar things that are going on like that. Problems at school, problems with family, problems with crazy relatives, all sorts of things like that. So don't think that because this is the most important thing in your life, it's going to be the important thing in everybody else's. And so you've got to give them this initial launch. And that happened at a 3 month mark. You are preparing material, you're preparing promotional materials, you're preparing the videos that go with it. I'll show you a couple of videos that will talk about that. So you're getting all the preliminary stuff ready. So you're not being a last minute merchant. If you are not well organised, as I said, get somebody that will come alongside you who is first rate at that, because they'll be good at the stuff that you hate. There again is a 6 week six weeks of services generally. There is a preaching series. There is a visitation of the parish. There are whole church announcements. In the last couple of weeks, there is a vision dinner, which is again trying to put the vision of the church front and centre. You're not asking for money at the vision dinner, but you are trying to cast vision of the glory of the kingdom of God and how this structure is going to make that forward. So, for instance, if you are trying to win Canberra, then whatever building you are doing, how does that contribute to the bigger vision of winning Canberra? That's got to be absolutely where you're going. And then you make a commitment day. You ask for offerings and normally three-year pledges. You can do it on one-year pledges, but then you've got to keep doing it every year. But often these things are worked out for the big building for the three-year pledges. Now, when I was doing, and I did this three times, and when we were doing it, we didn't ask for regular giving at the same time. That might have been a mistake, because it meant the next year we were limping through, but you're hoping that the joy and momentum of this project will carry you through the next year as well. And we scraped through on each year, but I didn't want the building, which was the big focus, compromised. Now remember I said to you before, you need six projects. But this is the exception to the rule, because this is the mega thing. And you want them thinking about this one mega thing, because if this falls over, you know, you're out the window. Oh, remember I talked about you pledge for the next year on the regular thing. Here you're pledging over 3 years, okay? Because what it means is that most people, they can't give you the amount of money that is needed for the project if you're just asking them one off. But if you're doing it over 3 years, then they can organise their life and they can make pledges for them to come in over 3 years. And that's generally the way it's done. Though, others, you know, I think places like Hillsong, they have a massive thing every year. They've got their own dynamics altogether, the way they do it. That's generally the way the processes have gone. Okay? Alright, in the 6 week period, in the campaign period itself of the 4 to 6 weeks, for us, it came at the end of the October holidays. I think I started the last week of the New South Wales school holidays in October, and then went through for the next 6 weeks. It just depends on what works for your year. Some people do it at the end of the financial year, and that will work as well for you. It worked for us, that way. You're needing visionary preaching. I'll come back to that in a moment. You're needing testimonies of God's grace in their lives and how God has changed them. The Bible asks for testimonies. Why shouldn't we? You're showing multimedia. I'll show you some of that. One thing you need to do is clear the calendar. All right? You don't want anything else messing up the calendar at this time. I got pretty tough on this. Because what you'll find is that the youth ministers want to have a camp in that time. or the women's committee wants to run a retreat or something. Well, you've got to get everything focused on this, because as soon as you dilute the energy, you're a goner, and there will be enough notices around this campaign to fill up your church calendar. You want everybody engaged, on board, and focused. One year, I remember this was just for a regular offertory, a regular commitment day. One of the ladies, who was a good lady, she came. She was a middle-aged lady who was going to be married for the second time. Her husband had died, and she came and wanted me to marry her. And it was in the middle of the commitment series. And I said, "Oh, yeah, okay, I can do that." I thought to myself, "Yes, I'm preaching on this, but this I've got enough time. I can." She gave me about 3 or 4 months' notice, and I know I'll be able to do the thing on the Saturday afternoon. We had a Saturday night service, but I can be finished and I can go forth for that. But honestly, it was a bridge too far, and I was just by the end of the series, I was just physically exhausted. And my wife was teaching in Canberra, had a conference in Canberra, and I went down with her and I stayed in one of the university things, and I got a migraine for the first and only time in my life. And I realized never again will I put anything else in the calendar except this. And for a commitment day thing, you know, you've really got to clear it off or you'll pay for it. You've got to distribute promotional materials. Unfortunately, it's hard to reproduce these things, and a lot of mine have gone. I'll leave some of them here you can have a look at. Here was our original Time to Build magazine. This is my only one, so please don't steal it. This is a Bible study thing that they had. That was another one for another campaign we ran on the building. that's one, Covenant Evangelical Free Church. Have no idea where that came from. And this one, lo and behold, I went up to Michael Murphy's church at Sutherland. That's where Scott Morrison goes now. Michael's not there anymore, but I went up and stole any ideas I could get out of Michael Murphy. And he was very generous. So I'll leave those there just for you to browse at, to give you an idea of the sort of brochures that you need to do. But please don't steal them, because I'll take pictures on them if you like. But they're my only copies, because I just can't live in a unit now, so I just can't keep everything I would like to. You need also a commitment service. And so that's the final day when you're asking people to bring their gifts in. Afterwards, you need a 1 to 3 weeks post-commitment day notices. In other words, you're encouraging people who've been away, and increasingly today, people are always away. They're away for very good reasons. And some of your most committed people might be only there 1 every 2 and 1 every 3, so you've got to keep doing this and giving them the opportunity. You've got to have, in the 3 or 4 weeks, you're making an announcement. You make some sort of celebration about the way in which the announcement gets made. I learnt this from Rick Warren, that when he announced his $22 million, they did it with bricks. So I copied him. Our first one was $1.8 million. And so I said that we bought a big bag of bricks, and I said to the congregation, every one of these bricks symbolizes $100,000. So we had a table, and I got one of the wardens to, I said, "Well, okay, let's count them all down." So he picks them up, and we put one, I said, $100,000. He puts the second one. So it's very visual. By the end of the time, people think $1.8 million. Oh, wow. You know, this is absolutely awesome. But it made a very visual, tangible expression of the money that came in. It wasn't as good as Rick's. Every brick was worth $1 million, so he got up to $22 million. that was the way we did it. So that was a very visual announcement. A lot of thank you material. On the anniversaries, you want to get up and, you know, because I said it's a 3-year pledge. So on the anniversaries, you get up, you talk about the campaign again, you tell people of where it's up to, because sometimes the building might be up and sometimes it might be not up. Ours was a total pain. because it was a very difficult site to do anything on. So after 3 years, I still didn't have a building up. It was a nightmare. I had to do it all again and ask for more money without a building, without anything to show for it. And I used to be saying, you know, like the ad, you know, it won't happen overnight, but it will happen. You know, I was saying those sort of things, that we were committed to making it happen. But so you've got to keep people up to date along the way, and you've got to keep celebrating along the way what exactly is happening each day. So at the first year mark, you celebrate, you give thanks, you ask people to recommit or newcomers to commit. Most of the time they don't, but you're still giving the opportunity. Then the second year you do it again. And the third year, you either finish it off and have a big party, or you've got to ask people to make their commitment a second time. We actually had to do three bites of the cherry because ours was a big, big project. I thought it was going to be a $2 million project. It turned out to be a $5.5 million project. That's what gave me ulcers. So, and then you might do a relaunch. So, that's the general thing. And I've whizzed through a bit of that. A lot of it's in the book, and we're going to come back to some of the details on it later. But I'll just pause again. Would you like to make a comment on this? Then I'll show you a video. I normally didn't do that, but one of the things I'm going to talk to you about later on is speaking into special groups. And if newcomers is one of your groups, I would simply say there'll be some of you here who've just joined our church, and you're just so welcome. It's just so fantastic. You probably don't know as much about the history of our church as other people do, but just to let you know, our church is about winning people for Jesus. That's what we're on about. And so this big campaign is because we love God and we want to fulfill the commitment of God that we feel that God has placed on our mind. And you might know all that much of it. I'd be more than happy to talk to you about where we're going to go. In other words, you can have a little commitment vision meeting with them. But I would just love to give you the opportunity to get excited about this project as the rest of us who've been here a long time. So I think what you're doing, what you've said is really important. If you identify a group that you think has got an issue, you don't ignore them. You actually speak into them. Yes. No, we did it in regular services, but the services weren't regular because they were the commitment day services, and so they were very special, and I preached a special message. Yep. Oh no, because and remember we've had a launch 3 months before. We've generally had some. If you're doing a big project, generally it takes some sort of congregational meeting to endorse it. So we had a couple of congregational meetings that endorsed these. Remember my first one that failed got 62% out of 66. We had two more that got 95 and then 98. And so people knew what was going on, but it was a matter of drip feeding some information, telling people what it was on about, and then having the launch the 3 months before, which was really saying, hey, folks, we're ready to go. And again, it's a vision casting sermon, and this is what we're on about, and we're going to be starting at such and such a time. And so when they come at such and such a time, then you've got your promotional materials which are being sent out. Then you're playing your videos over a 6-week period, and so you've got that sort of scenario that's gradually engaging people with it, and then finally really engaging people at the last. Well, yes. Sometimes the congregation didn't know some of the blockages, but I had to tell them. Sometimes the blockages mean that you really got to pray. I mean, seriously, you know, you think, you know, I think I'm praying a bit, but when you get the blockages, they really, really do, happen. I mean, we had answers to prayer that, looking back, are just simply astonishing. But I didn't particularly have to tell the congregation all that much about it, because they weren't even alert to the fact that there was a blockage. It was just that, you know, somebody in the council that, you know, sort of hated the project suddenly decided to let us have it because of a loophole or something like that. The biggest one that caused me most anguish was that, being Anglican, I had to get the approval of the diocesan, Anglican Diocesan Standing Committee, architectural panel, and a board and finance board to sign off on it before I could get a loan. You see, we raised a lot of money, but we also needed a $2.5 million loan because the project was so darn big. And we spent 6 months going through the mechanics of getting that loan with the local Illawarra Building Society. Now, in the timeline, if you can imagine, the building is going to start in January. The loan has been gone to the absolute nth hour, and it lands on the desk of some accountant in Sydney. And it's this thick, the loan documents. I mean, I didn't read through them all. I mean, it's just far beyond my capabilities. But on page 247, subnote C, it says the diocese will underwrite the loan if the church fails to deliver. That's what the building society is stuck into the clause, into the contract. Lawyer gets this and says, we don't do that. We don't underwrite. So we're talking Christmas Day is Tuesday or Wednesday. I get this land on my desk on Thursday before, and the building is due to start in 2 weeks' time. Do you pray about that? And I remember sitting there thinking, and this has taken 6 months. And I just thought to myself, Rod, you are supposed to be the great leader. Do something. But what? And I thought, this is a nightmare. I've got tax deductible money being given to this. People are going to lynch me if this falls over. Because once it's given tax deductibly, my wife's an accountant and she knew the Tax Act. I had the Tax Act there. I couldn't give the money back to them. I had to give the money to another tax deductible project. I mean, I'm going to be slaughtered. And so I thought, I'm just going to have to ring my bishop and just at least tell him that there's going to be a time bomb landing on his desk. So I rang him, and this is 5 o'clock on the Thursday afternoon. And he was sympathetic, and he said, look, maybe you ought to give Rodney Dredge a ring. And Rodney was the CEO of the business side of the Anglican Diocese of Sydney. Now, this is now after 5 o'clock. I'm thinking, yeah, give Rodney a ring. You know what it's like trying to ring some executive any time getting them, let alone ringing him after hours. But he gave me his direct line, and Rodney picks it up. And Rodney's a can-do guy. And he says, okay, what are we going to do about this? Have you got a good treasurer? I said, yeah, I've got a very good treasurer. He said, put me in charge. As it turned out, Rodney did a lot of banking with Westpac. My treasurer was the chairman of the Illawarra Retirement Trust. They also banked with Westpac. Cut a long story short, a magnificently named man called Bronco from the Westpac stitched up a loan in 3 days. 3 blooming days. Without all the clauses, and we went ahead. You just think, thank you, Lord, I cannot do this. But there were some of the things that sort of happened, and they were going on behind the scenes, and that's what the leader carries. I could tell you a few more of them too. But yes, one of the things that we did, as the building was up, but in a frame state, but not built, it was still dirt, but some of the frames, we figured out where the pulpit was going to be. And I got the congregation to write down the names of all their unsaved friends that they would like to invite to church. And then we put them in a canister and we buried them under where the pulpit was and we filmed it and we showed the people, this is what we're doing this building for. So that's re-energizing, you see. Now, okay, where do I get the ideas from? Well, I steal ideas from everybody. So it wasn't just that I thought them all up. I went and looked at everybody that had done any building campaign anywhere and found out what I thought was godly and honest and could work. But you've got to keep doing it. But great question. All right, I want to show you a building campaign. This is my... Yep. Very good question. This is easier than it seems. Okay? You might think it's hard. What I wanted of my parish council was to do one or two things a year. I wanted them to be engaged with the vision and to approve the vision, and that's all I wanted of them. I didn't want them running ministries and stuff like that, so we did a lot of work with them. I said that I hardly did anything with the names. What I did with the names was that when they came in November, and I knew who'd been giving what, I then started to think who I wanted on the parish council in March. And in any one year, we had about a dozen of people. And any one year might get a turnover of two or three. So I would then go to that list and I would look for people who had shown generosity by the way they'd given. Not necessarily the amount, but you know, I knew that if somebody was, you know, a poor widow, and we did have a poor widow, but I knew she was being very generous, she was on parish council. And I was very happy with that. So it wasn't her amount, it was the amount that the heart demonstrated. I would go to those people. They had to be leaders, they had to be godly character, and they had to be good givers. I would go to them and say, I would like you to stand for parish council next year. I didn't wait for them other people to figure them out. I went to them and I got them to get nominated, and I got them to put their name on the list. Then the other thing we did, and I strongly urge you to do this, in parish council meetings, we instituted a practice that in the middle of the meeting, in the middle, not at the start, not at the end, in the middle, we would break up into small groups and pray. We would pray for the church. We would pray for the vision. We would pray for one another. We'd do it only for 15 or 20 minutes, but it wouldn't be formal. It'd be little huddles of, say, four lots of three. And then at the vestry meeting, before the vestry meeting, when we're talk about who was going to be elected. Just before that, I would get up and say, look, this really important election's coming up. Got the vestry meeting. Love to have you all there. I just want you to know that you've got a wonderful group of parish councillors now. It's been just a terrific team, because pretty much always it was. And I want you to know that they're all generous people. They all sign the cards. They're all tithers. What am I saying to the congregation? Don't sign up. Don't you try and sign up if you're not prepared to jump onto this group of people. Then you say, I want you also to know that every meeting we have prayer in the middle of the meeting. We break up in small groups and we pray for the parish and we pray for you. In other words, if you are a shallow-minded part-time Christian whose faith is, you know, just very formal, you won't like our meetings. And so I would then fill the spaces up with people that had been pre-existingly, had agreed to those conditions. They'd be on the list. So Joe and Mary Bloggs, who thought, oh, gee, I might have a go, but weren't prepared to be generous and weren't prepared to be prayers. They thought, oh, I won't bother. So most of the time, just went through like a dream. And so I consistently had people all the time that were on board with the vision of the church and were generously supporting it. And so I just kept on regenerating them. And it was only one time that I had somebody want to jump on that I didn't know about that. She was a young woman, bright young woman, new to the church, and I called her into my office and we had a chat about it. She said, "I'm on." So I said, "Love to have you. Please stand." Now, at the end of the day, it's a free country. If they want to stand, they can. But I never had people who went through all of those hoops and still wanted to say, "I don't want to pray and I don't want to give, but I still want to be part of the leadership." It just didn't fly. And the great thing is, you see, this is what's great. You imagine the unspiritual people hate the praying in the middle of the meeting. Hate it, but they can't complain about it. Doesn't work well. The rotten rector, he wants me to pray in meetings. That doesn't sound very good, does it? It sounds awful. So they just don't want to go down that path and you don't have a problem. So yeah, the ongoing, we even set aside every second parish council meeting. We didn't do the financials. We set it aside for a vision meeting. So we would talk about vision every second parish council meeting. Got it away from a business meeting, had breakfast at somebody's house, ate together and then talked about vision and we prayed. Then the next meeting, the treasurer produced the money, the documents, but we didn't talk about them. Because as soon as you get the numbers in front of you, the people who want to go over it with a fine-tooth comb will say, "What's happened to this 5 cent here? Why was it spent?" You know, you get those sort of things. And, you know, I used to say to them, you know, if the money's coming in, it's good, it's great, and if it's not, it's my problem to deal with it. So, and they trusted me, and we had a very good treasurer and a very strong accountability system. Okay, let's have a look. This is Gaimia Baptist, and they're running a building. This is Carl Face, is the guy, a friend of mine.
Gaimia Baptist Church started on this site in 1949 from relatively humble beginnings in the home of John and Babs Turner. Later the church purchased a small ex-army communications hut and then later still they bought an ex-poultry shed which they used to meet in as a church. They used to wash it out each Saturday night to try and kill the smell ready for Sunday. Years later, they believed that the poultry shed wouldn't be big enough to sustain the future needs of the church. And so in 1962, they built this auditorium, the one we still meet in today. The auditorium is designed to hold more than 350 people, and that is a 400% increase from what they had before. But even this large auditorium wasn't big enough. And so just 6 years later, the church decided to build the Christian Education Center, which more than doubled the size of the church. This was for Sunday school for both children and adults. And now, 48 years later, it's time to stretch and grow again. So what are some of the lessons that we've learned over this past 50 years? Well, firstly, we should never allow the size of our facility to define the strength or size of our vision. Imagine if we were still in that poultry shed. There's so little things that we could do. Secondly, the increase in our facilities allows us to continue to grow and build our church. Some of the things that this church did through the 70s, 80s and 90s was only possible because the facilities were large enough to grow as a church. And thirdly, do you think those leaders of the church in 1962 and 1968 really understood all God would do through this church in the next 40 years? I doubt it. And do we understand what God will do with our church as we build our capacity? I don't think so. I think God will surprise us. This DVD is to tell you about some of our passion and vision for the future of our church. And we ask that you will join us in this exciting journey.
A number of years ago, I believe that God gave me a vision of the church as a vineyard with no trellis system. And as a result, the plants were lying on the ground producing no fruit. What they needed was something to grow up on. They needed some stakes in the ground. And I believe that my calling is in part to be providing those stakes of good biblical teaching and understanding of God. My passion and vision for the future is to see the church better prepared for mission, with a heart for the lost, with the skills to be able to share the gospel, and of course, all of that grounded on the solid understanding of the revelation of God in Christ Jesus.
My vision for Southern Community Welfare is that we can take what we have now, and with the team of Christian professionals that we've got, we can expand it. We can draw professionals, Christians, from both within Goyamee Baptist Church and within other churches, and that we can build a service together that really impacts this community and impacts our city with the compassion that I know comes to us from God.
My passion for life is that I might be able to help in some way to help people come to know Jesus more and more and become more and more like him. I love it when I see people living like Jesus, having the same kind of attitude like Jesus, and particularly loving like Jesus did. My vision for our church here at Goyamee Baptist Church is that we might become the most loving church in the Shire. I really believe we can do that. The way we care for one another, the way we encourage one another, the way we support one another. I love seeing that as people do that for one another. And as we do that, I really believe that it'll draw people to come to this place to be part of our home church. And we need greater facilities to accommodate all the people that will come here.
My vision for the church is that we use our resources, including the buildings and the people, to run programs like Manna so that we can impact our community, both locally and internationally, for God.
My vision for the youth and young adults ministry in the life of Goyamee Baptist Church is first and foremost that people come to know the Lord Jesus Christ. That alongside that needs to be people who are growing up in their faith, coming to a greater understanding and knowledge of who Jesus is and how on earth they need to respond to him and live in accordance to his desire and his will. For the youth ministry in particular, us having a new building is going to mean we're going to have more kids coming along on a Friday night. We are packed here on a Friday night, jam-packed each and every week. We don't have the capacity or the resources at this point in time to be able to care adequately for the kids that we have, nor do we have the capacity to be able to expand our ministry into the life of the community and the schools in our area.
Come and stand on the horizon with me and let's see what we can see as a community here at Goyamee Baptist Church. See, I see a community that actually longs to fulfill the very call that God has put on our lives, and that's to be a witness, to be a witness for Christ in this world. I see a community that actually longs to share their lives with not yet Christians. I see a community that is wise with our time, that we know the right time to spend and invest in family, and we know the right time to invest into people's lives that don't know Christ. I see a community that is actually confident to share the death and resurrection of Christ. I see a community where we as a people actually have a heart to see people come to Christ. I see in the future that a 600-seat auditorium will be far too small because we as the people of God will be making disciples through our personality. Let me ask you, when you look to the horizon, what do you see?
My vision of the future for Goyamee begins with a reflection of the past. As I look back at the last 25 years that I've been attending and just having seen God's faithfulness and the way he's used his church to reach into the community, it inspires me to look forward and just over the next 3 to 5 years with the building program, and then also to think of 25 years from now and just to think what those buildings will be used for in that interim period and from there forward as to what God does through his people here as we seek to honour him and remain faithful. I believe it's an exciting time and I really look forward to all that's achieved.
My vision for the children's ministry at Goyamee Baptist is that we would grow in the impact that we're having in our community, that we can reach out to more families and attract kids from our community to this church so that they can learn more about Jesus. With more space and greater facilities, we can reach more children and more families and make a greater impact in our community for God.
So what do we have planned? On these 3 blocks we've purchased, we're going to put 88 cars, including the space on the edge of the highway. This is very important because it allows us to have planning permission from council to do what we want to do on the other side of the road. We believe God has provided these in miraculous ways for us and opened up the opportunity for us to develop this site. So this is where I want you to start using your imagination. This will be the new part of the building. We're going to have a new foyer over here and a drive-through section, drop-off section here.
where the church bus is will basically be the front doors. And this whole area here will be a new auditorium. It'll hold 600 people, it'll have a flat floor, it'll have new lighting and sound systems as well as be air conditioned. On the far side of the auditorium, there'll be another 12 car spots.
Inside the building, there'll be a lot of changes, and they'll be done in two stages. The first stage will be to develop a meeting and communal area for us as a church. This whole space will be opened out. You can imagine this bottom area will be taken out, and we'll open into the new foyer and into the new auditorium. This space here will have a new roof over it, so it'll be weatherproof all the time. The area I'm standing now will actually be raised up, so it'll be on this level here, the same level as the kitchen and the same level as the auditorium. This we want to design as a cafe area where people can meet and talk and build relationships. In the second stage, we're going to put a second floor in the present auditorium to give us more space for children and for youth ministry. We're going to move the offices from downstairs to upstairs and open that whole area up for preschool. Southern Community Welfare is going to take more of the area upstairs. There's some wonderful plans for the future for space and the ability to grow together.
In 1960, the church leaders knew it was the right time to extend and build the facilities of Guymere Baptist Church. And for 48 years, our church has really enjoyed the fruits of their hard work and their commitment. We believe it's time to do that again. We believe it's the right time to extend ourselves further forward. And we want to encourage you and invite you to join us in this exciting endeavour. And who knows what God will do through our church in the next 40 years.
Great guy Carly endorsed my book, so he's got to be a great guy. I knew I had far too many slides to give you, and so a lot of the stuff that I've got on the slides will be explained in the book. What I can't show you in the book is another video. So I'm going to just show you one more video, then speak very briefly to two slides, because we've got some exciting things to do in the preaching thing, and I need to have some time to do that. So can we play the next video? This is Fig Tree doing its third attempt to raise money. Okay, this was the third thing when we tried to for a building, and we tried to set up the Fig Tree Foundation. And this was one of my swan songs. But again, because I can't show you this in the book, this is your opportunity to see it. Again, I'm not responsible for making this. I'm rather proud of it, but it was my clever staff that did it.
Imagine a church that loves God so much they can't wait to share Him with those around them. I hear
the music. Imagine a church where our children here come and are being transformed week by week. I am holding on
to the... Imagine a church where people find freedom and healing from their hurts, habits and hang-ups.
Imagine a church where every week God is working to bring people to faith in Christ.
We live in a region of spectacular physical beauty. Wonderful beaches, majestic escarpment and lush hinterland. And yet we also live in a region where people desperately need God. Jesus looked out on the folk in which he lived in his day, and he had compassion upon them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. Imagine a church that obeyed Jesus and loved people like that. At Fig Tree, we want to be just such a church as we pursue our vision to transform lives through the Lord Jesus Christ. This has always been a church that stepped out and had a vision to transform life for the Lord Jesus Christ. 25 years ago, men and women built the old building so that we could actually fulfill that vision. Is our new building, our new auditorium, our new foyer, is that an extension of the vision? Well, actually, no. The facilities, no matter how important they are, and they are important, the facilities are not the vision. People are the vision. The people who are in the foyer, the people who are in the auditorium, people whose lives are being changed by the Word of God, you are the vision. I just wonder what those folk 25 years ago, when they stepped out in faith, thought and wondered and imagined and dreamed that God could do.
When we as a church felt it was the time to move, there was really an incredible excitement. We were in a very small building over on the highway, small congregation, but there was a real sense that the church needed to grow and it needed a new platform for that. The core of the youth that were there at the time, we really saw that it would be an incredible platform for us to start doing some new things in youth ministry. So we were pretty excited about that.
The ministry did grow, and eventually we got to the stage where we outgrew the original premises here. And youth ministry was going very well. Sunday school was meeting over in the school across the road. And we were just busting at the seams, really. And so I guess about 10 years ago, it must be now, parish council took a very bold decision to do something with the property and to expand ministry here. And hence this building was, the vision of this building came to be a reality. But it was just wonderful coming into a building like this where we had space, where we could... expand the current ministry that we had. And now, of course, we have the opportunity to do even greater things through this facility.
I guess for me, now a parent and of two teenage kids, I'm just incredibly excited about the way this church now caters for my own children. The facility has allowed that, but not just the building. The facility has allowed the ministry team to grow amongst the youth group. And in turn, they're now looking after my two kids in a great way. I see them excited about coming to youth, about the programs that run, in their own personal growth. It's just exciting to watch.
The thing is that I just see so many new people coming to our church, people that I really don't know. And that's a great thing too, that we are attracting new people to come and obviously being able to reach them with the gospel week by week.
Well, what better investment is there if you can invest in God's kingdom? I mean, we each invest in our own homes, you know, whatever we do, but that is just so for now and so finite. But we invest in a facility like this, which then allows us to bless people's lives. You know, what better thing could you do with your finances in terms of supporting something which is really living and goes on?
Well, I look forward to the day when I have to get the church of 20 to 10 in order to get a seat.
A couple of years ago now, I first came to the youth group that runs on the Friday night, and in all honesty, that's because just one of my friends dragged me along, would be the best way of putting it, one of the Friday nights, and I just sort of realised that the youth group was a reasonably cool place, kept coming back to there until eventually at one of the services they were talking about God, and it just sort of suddenly made sense, and so I got down and I prayed with one of the guys there, and then I started coming to church. I brought my mum here once and she said that it's heaps different to church as she knew it, but I'd never been to church before, and so, you know, everything that happened here was sort of the norm to me, if you will. I think it's sort of a slowly but surely thing. Like, you know, you keep praying for change, you keep praying for help with whatever issues are happening. God's sort of making a bigger impact on my life, being more about God, you know, rather than the other world stuff that's slowly being squeezed out.
I joined the Bible study and I knew the people over there were normal and great friendship was developed there. And after that, I went to a service. I was really struck by your service there, your talk, and it was Easter day that I saw, oh gosh, you know, I saw Christ there, Jesus there, and he died for me on the cross of my sins, and I said, I have to give my life to this kingdom, to this cause that, you know, he was calling me that day, that time, and I remember me shaking and, you know, writing your care card, and since then people called me back and explained me more, and things were open. It looked like that curtain was open. Everything changed. It's just like I brightened up, and I saw in my husband different things that I never actually had a pleasure to see. I saw more colorful. The colors were striking, and I don't know how to explain. Everything changes, and I was craving for the Bible to study more, to know more about Jesus. I still am, and I hope this honeymoon never ends.
To help achieve this, in the past, we have conducted 2 3-year campaigns, and people have given very, very generously, wondrously generously to these campaigns. We still have, however, a $2.3 million debt, and that debt requires us to pay $320,000 a year to the bank to service it. That money attracts a tax deduction from the government. We also have a school scripture fund that also attracts a tax deduction from the government, and we're hoping to set up in the same way a music fund and a compassion fund to help Manor House and things like that. What we want to do is set up a simple, effective way of receiving these resources. That's called the Fig Tree Foundation. What we would like to do is to kick a massive hole in the debt. That's so we can move forward with our plans for transforming more lives through Jesus Christ in ministry, and to add extra facilities that will help us with kids, with youth, with training. Yes, we do have a debt. It's a big one. But this foundation is not about the debt. It's about investing in our future. It's about leaving a legacy. It's about having the resources to transform lives through the Lord Jesus Christ into the next generation. Why do we do it like this? Well, the government allows us to do so. By government law, we're able to attract money in 2 different ways. I want you to imagine that these 2 offertory plates are 2 ways that the government allows us to receive resources. The first way is for our general ministry. This will allow us to fund ministry to home groups, to pastoral care, to evangelism, to our utilities, for administration, to buy chairs, for all of those sort of things. The government does not allow us to receive a tax deduction from money given to those. What we ask you to do is to give your general offertories to the church first into this basket. However, monies given to the building fund or the scripture fund, or we hope the manor fund or the music fund, they do attract a tax deduction. And we ask you to give to those funds over and above your normal offertories. What we're trying to do with the Fig Tree Foundation is to bring all of this money under one umbrella heading in a simple, effective way to do it. Over the next 6 weeks, we'll be doing a sermon series called Imagine, and I'll be asking you to imagine what our church could be like in the future as we pursue our vision. There'll also be a series of Bible studies that are prepared on these themes so we can study them in our home groups, and there'll be some literature that will explain the Fig Tree Foundation in more detail. The Apostle Paul, in the letter to the Ephesians, prayed to God who could do far more than we could ever ask or imagine. So today I'm asking you to imagine what a church, our church, could be like in the future as we obey God. I'm asking you to pray that God would fill our church with spiritual power. And I'm asking you to give and give generously to the foundation and enjoy doing it. Thank you.
We've got a... Is that on? Yep. We're going to just break for lunch in a minute. I just want to wrap up. I would love to talk about those, but I just want you to note in both of them, you are honouring the past, you are celebrating the present, and you are talking about the future in terms of the kingdom of God and the way people play a part of it. And that's generally what to do. We could break those up. That would be really good. I've got a lot more things I could talk to you about, but it's all in the book, so please read the book. But I just want to give you two extra things, and then we'll break to lunch. They're both on the sheet, but on page 4, people want to know, how much do I expect? And I'll just be quick on this. The rough rule of thumb is that you can expect somewhere between around about 2 to 3 times your annual income. So for argument's sake, if you're in a church and your annual income is $100,000 over a 3-year pledge campaign, you might be able to expect $200,000 to $300,000. If it's $500,000, you can expect 2 to 3 times that. Fig Tree, the year we were doing it was about $700,000 the year before, and given and pledged was something like $1.8 million. So it was in that 2 to 3 year range, and about 1.5 of that actually came in. So the thing I'm telling you that is, sometimes people think this is, some of these figures are astronomical, but it's all relative to how much you're getting. A friend said to me yesterday, he was hearing about a church that had a $600,000 project. And people might think that's a big project. He said to me, that's a no-brainer. It was, because the budget of the church is about $1 million. So if you've got a $1 million budget in the church, regular, you can expect to get, by a campaign, 2 to 3 times that. So $600,000 is a walk in the park. You don't even gasp, you should go and do it. Secondly, the difference between a good campaign, well, a bad campaign is one that's done poorly with everything messed up, but the difference between a good and outstanding one is how you attract the big gifts. Because in a multi-million dollar campaign, what they call the deep pocket donors, the people who've got serious money, are much more important in terms of getting you over the line to the big amounts. I mean, they're not as important in terms of their generosity or anything else like that. But if you're trying to have a campaign that's going to raise $2 million, you're kidding. The youth group just hasn't got a chance of being in that sort of ballpark. You want his figure. Absolutely, because you want him invested or her invested. But it's the person that might be able to put down $500,000. And only a few people can do that. So it's the way in which you engage with those people, with those stakeholders, that is the difference between a very, very successful campaign and a reasonably successful campaign. Now, I didn't know how to do that at Fig Tree. I didn't know how, and when I was making that video, I didn't know how to do that process. When I was writing the book, I determined that I would go and find out. And so I spent 3 months researching exactly what you did with the deep pocket donors. So there's a chapter there, chapter 15, if you want to know exactly how you engage with somebody who's got serious money, again, read the book. It's time for lunch, and I've got an exciting session in the afternoon that I do not want to shortchange, so thank you.